remind you that for Microsoft Webcasts, you can go to microsoft.com/webcast. Thank you again for joining us for today's presentation, MSDN Webcast Geek Speak MVVM Patterns with Christopher Benaj and Rob Eisenberg. Now it's my pleasure to introduce today's first presenter, Glenn Gordon. Glenn, you now have the floor.
Great. Thanks very much, and welcome again to another episode of MSDN Geek Speak. As mentioned, my name is Glenn Gordon. I'm a developer evangelist with Microsoft, and my co-host on today's Geek Speak is Brian Johnson. Brian, how's it going?
It's going great, Glenn.
So what's going on in the community down in Florida?
Well, I don't have too much community info for Florida. Actually, I'm changing jobs.
That's right.
In a couple of weeks. And actually, my new job is as a startup partner evangelist for the East Coast.
Well, that's going to be
pretty
exciting.
I've actually changed gears, and I was up in New York last week for Internet Week, kind of meeting with startups up in New York, and I'll be up and down the coast talking to people about the Microsoft BizSpark program and about starting new companies with Microsoft software.
That's pretty cool. Well, if you run into any interesting technology topics when you're meeting with your startups, please, we can invite them on GeekSpeak.
I'll do that. I think there's. I've heard some people have pitched me some pretty interesting ideas, and so when we get ready to show some code, maybe we can have them on to show their products.
That's excellent. Cool. So Brian and I are developer evangelists, or at least Brian is for a little bit while longer, and we usually spend our time presenting at user groups and speaking at conferences, and we run into lots of folks in the communities, the developer communities for Microsoft out in the areas we visit, and we use GeekSpeak as an opportunity to bring those folks on and share their expertise. So rather than us doing the presenting today, we're going to bring on a set of guests and have them share their expertise around the topic today, which is on MVVM patterns. And we're going to encourage everybody who is attending this GeekSpeak Live to submit their questions using the question and answer pane in a live meeting, or if you're on Twitter, you can submit it through Twitter. Just tag your questions with the hashtag GeekSpeak. And we will be scanning that live for the next hour and pull your questions off of there. So our guests today are Christopher Benaj and Rob Eisenberg, and let's bring them on. So Christopher, you're based in Florida, which is also the territory Brian's in, right?
That is true. That is true, Glenn.
So what's your background? We've got your slide up here with your bio, but tell us a little bit about how you got involved with technology, and then specifically what's so intriguing about design patterns that just has you evangelizing them.
Okay, well, I started in the software business, 15 years ago maybe. Mm-hmm. Actually doing Lotus Notes development.
Oh, wow.
And, after a little bit of that, moved to Boston area, working for a company called PC Docs in the document management field, and got involved with SQL Server and VB, and actually, I think it was Flash 3 or 4 at that time. No, actually, maybe Flash, when it was still Future Splash. But picked up on Flash really early. That sort of sparked an interest in digital media and game development and whatnot.
Cool.
I'm sorry, say again?
Oh, I was just saying that's a cool background.
Yeah, and then discovered .NET, really because I was doing web work in ASP.NET, and switched from Visual Basic to C Sharp at that point and sort of never looked back, and have been doing .NET since then. And then Rob Eisenberg and I were friends, and that sort of led us into common interests of game development, which led us to WPF and Silverlight.
Cool.
Which I won't. I'll let him, I guess, speak a little bit about his background on that side.
Okay. Yeah, let's jump to Rob a little bit. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I guess a little bit about me, and this isn't in my bio, but my interesting background is I'm actually a classically trained musician, and so I'm a music theorist and a composer by trade. Music theory, I think, actually affected me quite a bit in terms of thinking about patterns and thinking about analyzing how things were constructed and put together and formed a final product. But I was basically, like Christopher mentioned, we were good friends, and I was teaching private music lessons at the time and getting back into programming, which I had done since I was a child, and I kind of stepped out of it to do music, and he said, there's this language called C#, and there's this thing called .NET, and and you should check it out. And so I was pretty reluctant at first because I kind of, at the time, thought, well, there can't be anything greater than C++ programming because, you know, you can do anything in C++. But my most recent memories actually were of Win32 programming. And so I stepped into Windows forums from that.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I said, there is nothing else. There's no, I can't go back.
I agree. I did the same kind of thing with WinForms. I was like, this is cool after doing MFC and C++.
Yeah, and I quickly kind of discovered that Christopher brought me in on a project he was working on, and that was about 4 or 5 years ago. It was my first professional gig programming, and a couple years after that, we started our company, and somewhere in the middle there, we started playing around with WPF, and the rest is history. Now that's pretty much what we do.
Gotcha. So. Okay. So just to remind everybody who is in attendance today that we are looking for your questions around the topic. You're going to help drive the conversation, which is related to MVVM and design patterns. So we had two different approaches, right? So Rob, you came out of the music background and figured out how sort of patterns apply. Christopher, was it sort of the haphazard way that some of the things that you've done before that drove you to an interest in patterns, maybe? I mean, basically, Lotus Notes is kind of all over the board, I think.
I went from chaos to increasing order.
Yeah.
I missed that in your initial question. I'm sorry about that. But what really drove me to patterns was really just wanting to get better at what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I was a software developer. I wanted to get better at it. And actually, a good friend of mine who is a Microsoft senior consultant, I'll drop his name, Alex Buck, he was getting turned on, I think, to extreme programming through some of the projects he was doing with Microsoft Consulting and
mm-hmm.
pushed me toward design patterns, recommended some things for me to start reading, and that was 8 years ago or so, I would guess, and that's really what sort of sparked my interest. And then from there, I started reading blogs and books and really wanting to see what other development communities like Java was doing and how that could influence what I was doing with .NET.
Right.
So that's sort of a very broad answer to how patterns entered my life. And then, of course, as Rob and I started working together, we sort of pole-vaulted one another. You know, it's pushing each other forward along that same path of trying to improve our craft.
Right, right. So, Christopher, would you say that in this day and age where technology is kind of changing around, you can just glance around and see links pop up or different things. A book that you read 8 years ago, is that just as valid pretty much today?
Yeah, I would say that. There are there's a number of books that retain most of their value because they're not about technologies.
Mm-hmm.
They're more about principles.
And techniques.
Sure, there's plenty of books that get outdated quickly, but there's a lot of books. I mean, the Gang of Four book is,
right.
You know, classic. A lot of the Martin Fowler series stuff. And actually, I'm not even sure, when was Robert C. Martin's?
That's 20 years ago.
Yeah. So his Agile Patterns and Practices. I mean, there was a more recent edition updated for C#.
First it was in C++, and then Java, and then C#. And so it's maintained its validity across multiple platforms and over a couple of decades. So,
and what's really fascinating, too, is a lot of really good ideas in software development have been there for a long time. In some cases, it was actually the fact that we didn't have fast enough hardware to do them. A lot of patterns really are only enabled by the fact that we have frameworks and hardware to support them now, which I think it's fascinating, actually.
I think that's cool, too, because I remember people used to go over this stuff and they'd say, well, yeah, that's pretty good in theory, but I want to write a performant application,
mm-hmm,
so I'm going to
mm-hmm.
use C, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. And a lot of people felt that way about, you know, runtimes and managed code. I don't want to do that because that's really unperformant, but being able to have that level of abstraction away from memory management, you know, so valuable.
And the maintainability, yeah.
Yeah, and you know what else, a part of this too now, when we have multiple processors and multiple pipelines and things, It's the kind of stuff that you wouldn't want to have to write by hand in order to take advantage of, you know, yourself. So I think that's interesting too. So it's like that now you almost have to write to the runtimes in order to get the most out of the hardware, and that didn't used to be the case.
Gotcha. Well, so guys, let's talk a little bit about design patterns in general and then maybe MVVM specifically. So some of the design patterns people might have encountered might be like ASP.NET MVC is an implementation of Model View Controller, and there's other ones like Model View Presenter. So what is the purpose of those in software design, and you know, what are the differences between them, and how, what makes you choose one over the other?
Okay. Well, I think one thing that would be useful to distinguish at the onset is that there are patterns at different levels.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is there are some patterns that apply to the overall architecture, and there are some patterns that apply to solving simple problems that may be at a method level or a class level. Patterns like MVC, MVP, Model View View Model, those are more architectural. Those are high-level patterns.
It's a guiding principle that's going to govern how you're going to build, say, your entire UI tier, as opposed to something like the singleton pattern, which just describes the instancing behavior of a single class.
So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind in that question. Now, to go back and say, well, how does the MVC, I guess, compare to the MVP, compare to the view model? I don't know, maybe that's a good place to talk a little bit about the history of those patterns, because they all...
Yeah, this is where it's quite fascinating, I think. If you look back, and Christopher mentioned earlier that a lot of these ideas, they go quite far back. So if you actually look back at Smalltalk 20, 30 years ago, that is kind of the place where the model view controller pattern originated. And basically what all these patterns are under the umbrella of separated presentation. And this was kind of Smalltalk's big contribution to the software development community at large, was this notion of separated presentation, which is that in a UI tier, you have classes that perform different roles. Some classes are strictly for visualization, some are for business logic, some mediate between those components or manage those components. And in the original model view controller architecture of Smalltalk 80, you had the model, which was your business object,
right,
the view, which was the visual representation, what you would see on the screen, and then you have this interesting thing called a controller. And this tends to be the place where these different patterns actually vary. And in the original MVC implementation, what we think of as controls, like a text block or a text box or a button, each of them had their own view and their own controller. So if you had a form, imagine like a data entry form, and you had a couple of text boxes on there and a button, each one of those text boxes would have a view and a controller, and the form as a whole would have a view and a controller.
Okay.
And the controller in that original architecture was much, much lower level, and it dealt with handling user input at a lower level. So say when you press the key on the keyboard, what would happen is those controllers would collaborate to figure out which one of them was supposed to handle that key press. And then at that point, when that was determined, that controller would then take the input from the keyboard and push it through to the model. The model would update itself, and that would cause the view to update itself. And that's actually, there's a lot of really interesting things about that, just the low-level nature of the controllers, and also the fact that a key press didn't update the text box control. It updated the model, which caused the text box control to update. And there's a lot more nuances to that, and we'll get some links where people can go and read the history about that. But it's actually quite a bit different from what we're doing today, because as the UI frameworks evolved, the control models became a lot more complex and a lot more intelligent. Let's just say intelligent. So when we think of something like later versions of Smalltalk, and when we think of things like Windows Forms, the button control has these higher level click events and so forth on it. It handles the input itself, and it is the view kind of all combine into a single component. So that sort of innovation actually caused a change in the pattern, because now there's no need for the controller in MVC anymore,
mm-hmm.
because it's been incorporated into the control architecture itself. So then this thing called ModelView Presenter came about, because the next problem that they had was, well, now we've got this model and this view, and we've got to have some way to synchronize the two. So the presenter came back into existence sort of as a evolution of the controller. But the thing to note here is that we still have this idea of separated presentation going on in ModelView Presenter, and we still kind of have this triad of roles. So what the presenter would do is it would basically keep the view and the model synchronized, essentially, and it would do some other sort of management things, but it kind of glued the two together, mediated between them. Now, the next kind of UI framework innovation that changed the whole thing was data binding. And so it's really interesting to see how that affected the pattern as well. Now, in frameworks like Windows Forms, the data binding mechanism was fairly primitive. It was early data binding, much like before we had early versions of control frameworks and then kind of more advanced controls. We then got early data binding. And we kept the model view presenter pattern at that time, but also the notion of a presentation model entered the picture. Because we did have data binding, we could actually have a simple model that was rendered entirely by being bound to a view, without any need for a separate class to synchronize them. So without the need for that presenter. But data binding wasn't advanced enough for that to be used exclusively. So what we often had was a model, view, and a presenter, where the model in this case was actually a presentation model. And sometimes it was a business object model. It would depend. But the introduction of data binding kind of evolved this new presentation model piece into the picture, and people were starting to use a mixture of MVP and presentation model. Now you get WPF, which has an extremely rich data binding capability, far beyond what Windows Forms had. And what happens is that presenter starts to fade out more, because we have a lot of synchronization capabilities in the data binding. So what you end up with is your views and this presentation model, and the WPF community has kind of rebranded that term as view model. So here's how we get the view and the view model. So the view model being some class that is synchronized with the view through data binding, and it's kind of it is an abstract notion of the view. It's almost like a skeleton, and the view is the flesh hanging on top of it, maybe. So they're synchronized via data binding. And then, of course, we can introduce the model back in there, a model view model, to bring back in our underlying business objects again. So oftentimes your view model will proxy to an underlying business object, or will be created from the data in a business object. So that's where you kind of get that triad again of the model, the view, and the view model. And that's kind of how it sort of evolved over time. Perhaps that was a long explanation, but it's really kind of simplified too. There's a lot of really interesting factors involved. But the advancement of the controls and the advancement of data binding have kind of taken that original MVC style pattern and kind of morphed various components of it over time to what we're using in WPF and Silverlight now.
And Glenn, you asked what how that relates to ASP.NET MVC. So to kind of tie that in here, so within a web framework, of course, you're having a very different metaphor for the way the application works in terms of, you know, that the stateless, you're sending these requests off and whatnot, is very different from the way a desktop application works.
Right.
And some of the concepts actually are a little bit closer to the original MVC back in the Smalltalk days, where the controller is a class whose responsibility is to interpret the input of the user. So that controller is taking the URL and trying to figure out what to do with it. And then from there, it's populating some sort of model, manipulating some sort of model that it in turn renders back as a view. And one thing to me that was really confusing that I think is worth pointing out here is that these patterns, particularly using the term MVC and MVT, it's sort of like barbecue sauces at restaurants. Everybody's got flavor, you know?
Yeah.
And there's variations everywhere you go. And
that's why the history can be kind of confusing because even after original Smalltalk MVC, there was the Smalltalk MVT pattern. There were various... There were several different methodologies to implementing it, and so it's a very interesting history and a lot of variation. Just interesting to see how people solve real problems with it.
Right.
One interesting note too is that I was first introduced to MVC as a pattern actually through Flash development, and the primary selling point of it there was that you could change the way the application was rendered without changing the logic. Of course, which is very true in Silverlight and WPF mm-hmm. as well.
Right. Are you seeing usages of MVVM within Silverlight as well as WPF?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
A matter of fact, I mean, if we go into it later, the Caliburn framework that's sort of Rob's baby is cross-compiling to both Silverlight and WPF, and it's really meant to facilitate the use of the model.
Okay. So in the solutions that you work on, where does MVVM come into play? Is it WPF? Is it game specific, or is it business app specific, or you know, where do you find yourself utilizing that pattern a lot?
Pretty much any WPF or Silverlight application that Rob and I write is going to be using using the MVVM.
Okay.
At this point. And what's interesting is that we started WPF development. Well, our first project was the Microsoft Code Challenge back before 3.0 was released. It was actually the beta version. So we've been doing WPF development for a while, and what we currently do is sort of the result of all of our experiences along the way of realizing, oh, this hurts. Let's find a better way to do this so that we're not causing ourselves so much pain, which led us to read people like John Gossman's blog and I think Daniel Crevier, I'm not certain how to pronounce his name, where they were blogging about these issues years ago. I mean, I think Gossman is...
I think it was 2005 when he wrote the original blog post about MVVM, I think.
And really, so it was our search for ways to be more effective and to really have less pain in our development that drove us along this path. And I mean, I'm willing to say that it's 90 to 95% of what we do really follow this pattern now. I mean, there's a few exceptions where the return on investment's not high enough to warrant it.
Right.
But
that's a very small percentage.
Yeah, it's a very small percentage.
Yeah, we kind of talked about this before a little bit. What, like, you know, if we went by a year, because a lot of the cost of software ends up being cost over time, you know, how do I maintain this application, especially if I'm a business or something. So what is the best case, like, for an application that uses this pattern, you know, over a 2 or 3 year period? What can I expect for that versus using some other kind of pattern?
Well, I'm a big believer in all best practices really resolve to saving time and money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, one of the reasons I was drawn to the MVVM because, I mean, we're a small consulting shop. We really want to bring value to our clients. We want to do the best we can, and it's all about saving time and money. And one of the core concepts underlying most design patterns is the idea of separation of concerns. And by that, and that's actually why we refer to these patterns as separated presentation patterns, because we're trying to separate out the presentation concerns. And with the MVVM pattern, we're able to separate out some of that presentation logic so that it's not mixed in and muddled in with other code. And that really allows us to isolate changes. So when there is a bug, when there is an extension, when there is something we need to do 6 months, a year from now, we have a higher degree of confidence that the change we're going to make is isolated to one area because the code is written in such a way that where it partitions itself. Another side effect of that is that you know, automated
regression testing using unit tests, you can pretty much run your entire application out of unit tests. And so, 6 months, 2 years on the run, you're making that change, you can run it, those unit tests, and have a high degree of confidence that your change isn't breaking anything else.
Cool.
And that's really hard to do if your presentation layer is not separated out.
Right. I mean, you're better off using any kind of separated presentation pattern than none, of course, even if you're not using model view view model. One of the reasons that model view view model works well, like I pointed out earlier, is because of the data binding capabilities of WPF, but also because if you look at how WPF itself is architected internally, it follows these kinds of patterns. So let's take, for example, the control model. Every control is essentially the behavior, the code for the control, and a default template. Mm-hmm. So really what you have here is, and you can replace the template for any control in WPF. It's the idea of lookless control. Well, that's really a view model, which is the control, and a view, which is that template. So WPF itself sort of mirrors these kinds of concepts throughout, and that tends to make architecting your application-specific components work a lot better when you're sort of mirroring the way that WPF works. Also, another interesting aspect is that WPF, every time I say WPF, I mean Silverlight as well.
Yeah.
They're both frameworks built around the idea of composition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So basically, you can think of your entire user interface as a tree. Now, one of the interesting things about ViewModel is when you start building sort of intricate user interfaces, you can start composing your view models. So you can start creating these hierarchical structures of view models where one view model has some properties and maybe a collection of more view models. Each one of those maybe has some properties and a collection of more view models or a single view model. And what you end up having at that point is a design pattern called application model. And you end up with a single structure basically that represents the runtime state of your entire application, because it mirrors the views. So the views are hierarchical and the model is hierarchical. So manipulating the model in any way automatically manipulates the view, and you can get some really interesting side effects from this, such as being able to save the state of your application at any point in time. Just serialize the view model and deserialize it, and your application, every aspect of your application comes back up exactly. What was selected, what windows were docked where, what document you were looking at, what tabs were open, all the details,
mm-hmm.
because the application model has a set of hierarchical view models represents the entire state of the application. The other interesting thing you can do is that you now have a very powerful way to automate your entire application, because all you need to do is plug something like the DLR in there, then hand the script engine the instance of your application model, and now anyone can write scripts to automate your entire application.
Wow.
So that's kind of a pattern that has flown out of us using model view view model a lot, where we tend to start creating, we tend to start applying composition to view models and composing them together such that we end up with an application model. And that maps really well to WPF because of its composition orientation.
Gotcha.
So these, there are a lot of separated presentation patterns. Using any of them is better than not using something at all, but using things like model view view model, a little bit of model view presenter, application model, these patterns really work well for WPF because they mirror the same types of architectural patterns that are in WPF. So,
cool.
And to tag on to that, I think that WPF and Silverlight developers who may not be familiar with these patterns are likely to reinvent these patterns because they are inherent in the framework and because they solve problems. They ease pain.
Right. In fact, one of our attendees is asking if there's going to be any MVVM templates in Visual Studio.
I believe there is a plan, actually. I have only read a little bit about it, but I believe there is a...
I don't doubt it. I mean, Microsoft WPF framework team is taking a lot of interest in what the community is doing now. The advantage we have now is that WPF has been out for 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. And we've had an opportunity to kind of establish some practices and some principles that we use to build our apps. And so now the Microsoft is kind of looking back out at us and seeing, okay, what are they doing? How are they doing this? And what are some ways that we could, even improve the framework to make these things easier or improve starting a new project to guide people down this path? You know, maybe in the same way that MVC, you right-click and you say add new controller or add new view and these kinds of things. I think that they're thinking a lot about it. They're taking it very seriously.
I thought I had seen this, and I just double-checked it. On CodePlex, there is a WPF model view v model toolkit on CodePlex at wpf.codeplex.com.
Wpf.codeplex.com. Okay.
Has a VS template that it has there, and then some introductory material. So
now I have not used that though, because a lot of what Rob and I do is really related to the Caliburn framework.
Right.
Which we has put into a lot of. I mean, we've harvested a lot of our work and put it into that framework. So.
Cool. Okay. Well, do you guys want to spend a bit of time here sharing out some code and what it looks like when people have actually implemented this, what it makes
sure.
it look like?
Sure. Well, see, we have a lot of examples.
Yeah, we have quite a few. So
why don't we start by talking about the Math.net meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not going to show the code for this first example, but I'm going to show the app and explain how it works. This is an application for a company we've worked with called IFC.
Okay, you guys need to share it out.
Sorry about that.
Yep.
Let's see.
Go under the content window. There you go. Great.
All right, yeah. This is an application where we just did the front end work for this application. And it is a tool that this company produces map running software. Actually, it's really fascinating. They use WPF to do their rendering, which is really kind of cool on the server side. But they work with what is Bing Maps. It's no longer Virtual Earth, right?
I always love seeing development environments implemented in code. It's cool to see the trees and the different windows.
Yeah, this is actually really fascinating. Really fascinating because basically what this application does, it lets you style your maps. So, you know, say you have a map of park data for, you know, the state park system, and you want to make sure that all the rivers are dotted blue lines and all the parks are outlined with yellow and have their labels with an icon of some sort. This is a tool written entirely in WPF that lets you do that. It actually uses XAML for all of its assets as well. It's actually kind of cool. But what's really fascinating about this interface here. Actually, it's slightly off the screen. Let me shrink it down there. What's cool about this interface is that this is all built on ViewModel premise, and this interface is composed entirely from a model using templates.
So right. If you look at the kind of the content area of this app right now, everything, and I mean everything, is data templates. There's no code behind. There's just a view model. It's a hierarchical view model. In fact, every property you see in those property grids is the model itself. And the entire view that you see there is simply just a rendering of data templates over a rich hierarchical model, view model, basically.
This is something that really excited us when we wrote it because it, it literally is an object graph here that's just being rendered. And actually, I would like to at some point create a test app to demonstrate how this works. I mean, we can't share the code for this because it's the company owns it. Really cool what you can do with it. But let's move, I guess, on to some real code examples here.
Ones that we can show you code for.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting example of of how far you can go with it. Of course, the tree view that you saw on the left-hand side of the screen was also its own view model, and so pretty much the entire application was built along those principles. But that styling content area there is kind of a really advanced example of using these hierarchical view models and how far you can go. It's completely automatable, right? Because there's nothing in code behind, so you can unit test that entire user interface without worrying about bringing up a window. So,
right. So here is some code that's actually available on CodeFlex. It is it's a line of business sample application in Silverlight that is using the Caliburn framework that is built on all these principles here. So we'll start off by showing you the application itself.
Then it's really just a simple application. It's got kind of a home view here, and you can navigate here to a contact list. That was probably pretty quick, but it loads them up from a web service, and I can dig into this contact, and I can make some edits here. Oh, and there's something wrong. Must provide a last name. There's a summary view up here. I can actually go into that summary view and use your mouse. Click on the error, it highlights the place that the error originated, so on and so forth.
So I noticed this is a web app versus a WP app, right?
This is Silverlight.
Oh, it's a Silverlight.
This is actually Silverlight.
Yeah, okay.
And it does some fun things like detecting that things are invalid and gives you some options and does deep linking. You can see the URLs are changing up here as I navigate around. And now the interesting thing about this app again is that there is no code behind for the entire application. It's basically that kind of hierarchical view model pattern that we talked about. So I'll show you a little bit of what it looks like in code. Normally with one of these kinds of architectures, you have to have some sort of bootstrapper code to get everything kind of started up. For this app, and for most WPF or Silverlight apps, it makes sense to kind of put that in the app. Mm-hmm. So you can see, we also use quite a bit of inversion of control, so I won't dig into that too deeply, but this is based on Caliburn, and one of the things you can do with Caliburn is provide the framework with a root model. So notice here that we start by basically instancing the root of our application model. I can take you over to the implementation of that over here. And you'll notice that it has some pretty interesting things hanging off of it. So when you saw that dialog pop up that said, can you save, do you want to save? That was actually a property on that root model. So the appearance of that dialog is actually based on whether this value is null or not. When it's not null, it's an instance of a view model which is bound to a view and displayed to you. And this class actually inherits from something called Presenter Manager, which has a collection of presenters on it.
And presenters in this context are view models.
Are view models. So we kind of use a mixture of model view presenter and model view model to build most of our apps, just depending on how much explicit control the model needs to have over lifecycle and various other issues. More explicit control equals more towards the model view presenter. More implicit through data mining kind of leans more towards presentation model. So it's kind of a continuum even between these patterns, and a lot of times we use both together.
And actually maybe something good to interject here too is that one thing we've discovered is that that these view models tend to fall into two categories roughly. Although the lines are very blurry a lot of times, but sometimes our application will be dealing with a lot of data that we need to render, so the view model will essentially be some graph of data. So if you take that map application we showed a second ago, we might have a whole family of maps. Within each map, there might be layers of the map.
there might be different a whole graph that represents what the style data looks like. It's very much some sort of a tree structure of data that the application is manipulating. Other times we find that that these view models are more like actual what you think of as screens. So for example, we have a tabbed interface and we have a set of tabs across the top that we need to know this tab was activated, this tab was deactivated, this particular view was initialized.
So kind of some lifecycle issues to the screen itself, you know, activation, deactivation. When you're trying to close out a record that's dirty, it's kind of the notion of trying to shut down the screen. So these are kind of lifecycle issues. Those things to be more presenter-like and less view model-like. So, but there are different concerns if you're in a lot of applications. So, but basically, you know, when you load up this demo app, you see that home screen and you see those buttons on the home screen, and each one of those buttons basically gets bound to these different methods, which asks the shell to open up some other presenter or view model. And so what we're doing is actually constructing this hierarchical model as, you know, over the course of the application. So we have that show model that has injected into it the home presenter, but when you click one of those buttons, that instance of the model gets replaced with, say, the customer list, right? And there it is right there. Notice that this has a bindable collection of contacts.
Okay.
Right? So each one of those then gets data bound as well. So each of those tabs, when I opened up the contact Rob and a tab appeared, each of those was actually an instance of a model, an instance of contact details present, which has its own single contact. And I'll just, let me run the app again so you can see how this plays out. So we're looking at the view, but from the model perspective, what we actually have here is the shell, that shell model with its current child model being the home model.
So let's look at the markup for that. I think that might add some clarity.
Yeah, we'll look at the markup as well. So I was just trying to... oh, it just crashed. We crashed Visual Studio.
Now the caliber framework that's in there, that's available on CodePlex too. You guys wrote that, yeah?
It is. And it's really based around making picking up some of the slack where WPF leaves off in terms of being able to do synchronization and things. So WPF is really good at data binding properties, but if you want to have a button trigger some code to happen, you have, you know, in Silverlight at least, you have to fall back to wiring up an event handler and getting an instance of an object and calling it. In WPF, you have commands, so you can actually, on your model, hang instances of iCommand off and then data bind to those commands. But what Calibern does is it lets you bind directly to methods on your view model. So it bypasses the glue code of either event wire up or the kind of view code that the glue code that you need sometimes with commanding, and lets you directly bind user interface elements to methods on your model. And it does a bunch of other fancy stuff too. It gives you multiple parameters, lets you do asynchronous execution and things like that. But
and I'm realizing too, we sort of jumped into some of the deeper stuff about going through maybe some of the one-on-one 101 material. Maybe we should take a step back and show a more simple example.
Hey, can I ask one question from the queue quick?
Absolutely.
So somebody, William, asked the question, when you have a view model that contains observable collection of view models, how do you get notification to the view that a property in the lower view model has changed?
Okay. And the answer to that is that each item in observable collection, we would expect to provide its own change notification. So that,
I'm just guessing the listener is actually assuming that that is already in place. I think it's the issue of how does the parent model know that something specific happened in one of its child models.
Oh.
There's a couple ways you can do that. I mean, assuming you implemented iNotify proper change on the children, the parent could just wire up for changes on the child and look for specific things. That's one approach. Another approach is if you're using inversion of control, if your parent model happens to be a singleton, when you create each of those children, you can simply have the container inject an instance of the parent into it. And rather than the parent observing the child then pushes information to the parent. So those are kind of two different approaches to doing it. It really depends. I'm sure there are more as well. You could use an event aggregator and have global events that they, you know, what the child publishes and the parent listens to. Prism, which is another framework that Microsoft published for doing these types of architectures, one of its main features and strong points is it has an event aggregator mechanism, which can be used for that kind of scenario. So,
which Prism is a very good resource, by the way.
It is. It's great for modular applications. Again, they embrace this idea of componentization. They have a great module framework for doing lazy loading of models, and they have an event aggregator, and they also have some extensions to WPF's commands and an implementation for Silverlight. So using that can actually help implement these patterns as well and solve some of those problems. I was on a Prism advisory board back when they first did it, and at that time I had some overlap between Caliburn and them, and I just tried to strip out some of that overlap. So it's actually the two frameworks actually complement each other quite well. So you can use event aggregation, commands, and modules from Prism, and then combine that with some of the other pieces, like some of the presenter-based classes and actions from Caliburn, and really have pretty much an end-to-end solution for building just about any type of WPF or Silverlight app. Both frameworks are available for both platforms. So
yeah, let me mention too, somebody had asked the question, what's the CodePlex address? And so CodePlex is codeplex.com, CodePlex.com. And then your Caliburn is spelled CaliBurn. So you can go to codeplex.com/Caliburn to get to that.
And the Prism is on there as well. So there's actually been a rise in the number of these types of frameworks. There's actually 7 or 8 now. And some of them take some really different approaches from each other. So it's actually really interesting to think about your specific application and which one of those frameworks would make the most sense for the style of application that you're building. And there's quite a bit out there to, you know, to drop into your application and use immediately, or in addition to just study and learn about how these patterns play out. A lot of them have sample apps. Prism was actually, the framework for Prism was actually extracted out of a reference example that they built. So they have a full application you can download and study and see how these things work out. Caliburn has, we showed you one of the, you know, we're looking at one of those examples, and it has a number of other samples, so you can see as well how these patterns play out in real applications. Another big framework is InRoute, and there are some samples for that as well. So you can kind of dig in and see which frameworks meet your style of application, and you can really learn how people have employed these frameworks to tackle real problems. If you don't want to use a framework with WPF, you can get pretty far with using just commands and data binding, although you will hit some really sticky issues most likely at some point and wish that you had a little bit more. So it's a matter of deciding what the return on investment is in terms of bringing it a framework versus, you know, writing extra code yourself versus just using what's out of the box.
Right, right.
Obviously, we wrote Caliburn, so we use it on everything, but and it came from hitting those sticky issues and wishing that we had something more, but it's not something that anyone can just up and write, you know, in a day's time and solve their problems, so
sure.
It's not worth it to craft that from scratch for everybody, so we put it out there.
Gotcha.
Let's use.
So you've got up there now is a sample app with some of the basics, maybe, of
Yeah, I do. I do. And I probably should have started here. I apologize for that. This is something else on CodePlex where I was trying to demonstrate the various patterns for building a user interface. And the first pattern here actually is the anti-pattern. This is a bad pattern. This is the way we usually work, right? Or the way is the typical approach. So actually, first I'm going to run the app. Wow, I crashed Visual Studio again. Okay, I'll explain the app while I'm bringing it back up. It's a very simple scenario, highly contrived. You have a form to register a user. We just want to have some simple validation, such as making sure that our email address is correct. I'll open that up first. And that our passwords match. So here's the real simple application. We can put in some stuff. We see the real time. It's checking to make sure that everything's okay and that we can't click register until everything's there. I didn't actually do any pattern matching on the email address, but you get the gist.
Mm-hmm.
The autonomous view, we call it, which means that the view is responsible for everything. The logic is actually in the code behind file here. And if you look at the XAML, you'll notice we name all our elements here. Registration button, we have a validation summary, items control for containing our messages. We have a grid here with using WPF's attached events to catch all of the text changed events inside of it with text boxes for email and password and confirm that. And that's pretty much it. Of course, the registration button we saw there. If we look at the code behind, it's sort of what you'd expect. There's an event handler that is going to execute the registration when it's clicked. All it's doing is delegating that to this registration service, which is really an empty class just for demonstration purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime the text change event fires, it checks to see if the form is valid by checking each of the individual controls to see if their property is valid. And if there's a problem, it reports that problem. And then at the end of it, it sets the registration button to enable based upon that. Now, in this case, this code is very tightly coupled to the XAML.
Right.
I could very easily break this, by changing the name of the text box or doing something with the text box. Lots of ways to easily break it. So sort of the next step. Now, I want to show you very quickly two intermediate steps that have historically been important that are not necessarily what you would do with WPF. The next step is the passive view. This is sort of the way you would do a lot of WinForms, or a lot of WinForms, I guess, are written this way. In this case, we have a controller, which is an abstraction of the view in some sense. It has logic for doing validation. It handles registering the actual registration by passing that on to the service. It has a mechanism for reporting problems. However, it is aware of its view. So it takes an instance of its view here. And the actual XAML, if we look at it over here, in the code behind, we'll see that it implements this interface, this iRegistration view, and then here's where it gets ugly. We have to actually expose all the properties in that interface so the controller can operate on it. So this is called a passive view because the view doesn't have any logic in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's passive, but the controller is working on it. So it extracts information from the view.
And this is a flavor of Model View Presenter right here, where this registration controller is literally handling the synchronization between the model, if you will, which is essentially the building up of the information for the registration and the view. So it's manual synchronization between the two here.
And I won't go into it for time's sake, but I actually have in the source some very simple tests to show how the automation testing can work with that.
It's very unitestable, so that's one good thing about that test.
The next one up is the supervising controller.
Now, this is called a supervising controller. This is another flavor of Model View Presenter. In this case, though, we actually employ some data binding. So here, the controller will actually it looks similar, except for there's no dependency on the actual view. This doesn't know anything about the view. It also, though, has this model hanging off of it called a registration model. Let me look at that real quick. Registration model is just going to have an email address, an email and a password, and it's going to raise change notification when those are changed. Now, this is highly contrived example. your model might be very different, but the supervised controller is going to moderate between the model, this registration request, and the actual view. So if we look at the view for here, and I'm really hoping Visual Studio doesn't crash, there we go, we actually see bindings now. We see the isEnable is bound to the isForm valid. Okay. If we look at the code behind for this, we'll see that the code behind, there's not much to it, except for taking our presenter, our view model, because this is really a view model, and setting that equal to the data context. Now,
this is an area where sort of your model view model sort of starts to trend, you know, there's a gray line between presentation model or view model and model view presenter. So you can kind of see as data binding starts to come into the picture, you start to flow from the supervising controller into the view model a little bit here.
Now, one thing about this is that we still have the button click event handler, and we're having to retain an instance of our controller so that when we raise this event, we can call our register method
sure. On
our controller. And then that does its work using the service and the model on the back end. So now the next step up from this is actually a view model. So the view model, as Rob mentioned earlier, as it's stated in Josh Smith's excellent article in MSDN, actually, I should put a plug for that. He's got an excellent article in what month was it?
We'll find it after the webcast, and we'll put it up on the GeekSpeak blog.
Okay.
For everybody to access. But what's the author's name again?
Josh Smith, and it was the February 2009 MSDN. So the next step in the progression really is the view model. Now, we mentioned it earlier, but I don't think we drew the connection, but view model is synonymous with presentation model. It really means an abstraction of the view. And since WPF's data binding system is so mature, that allows us to do a lot more in the view model than we could have done with previous UI frameworks and solve some problems that we had with the supervising controller. And actually, though, this view model still isn't quite all the way there yet. Let me open up and look at it. You'll notice it looks really similar to our supervising controller, except for that we've merged the model itself into the controller. So it might be better for me to rename this to registration view model, not controller.
Yeah.
But now the isForm valid, the email, the password, the confirmation, that's all present on this class here. Again, the XAML looks almost identical. We just have a bunch of bindings. But instead of the bindings in the case here going to model.email, they're actually going straight to the controller. Now, here's where it gets really, really interesting.
This final version is sort of the version that most people doing WPF or Silverlight for a while. This is what they think of as view model.
Okay.
So the main problem with WPF out of the box, vanilla, is that there's not a way to bind to methods. Now, there is an abstraction called commands, and you can bind to commands, but it's hard to hang commands off of your classes. So you have your view model. You really want to expose these methods as classes, as commands, but it takes a little bit of work. So if we're looking at this view model, this is... Again, I probably should have named this registration view model. We have, you know, what you would expect, properties that raise change notification. But if we come down here, we now have this interesting property called register command.
And if we look in our XAML, at our button, we see our button now is bound to the register command right off the view model. Now, we have a little bit of some fancy footwork going on here that we'll explain. This is a little Fluent interface that Rob and I use to create commands on the fly, if you will. Notice that this is taking a lambda right here that actually is what we want the logic of the method to be. In this case, it's really simple. It's just delegating to this registration service, calling its register method, and passing in information into it. I think Josh Smith uses the term relaying command. We use the term delegating command.
You'll see both of those terms used pretty often. This is a really common solution to kind of one of WPF's shortcomings right here in order to get view models working a little bit better.
Now, so in our case, I won't go too deep into this. So we have this class called delegating command. And again, this is all on CodePlex. So you can see it takes an action, and it basically implements the I command interface for us and calls these actions whenever the command is executed. So it gives us an instance of a command that we can bind to, but allows us in the class to define what that command actually does by passing in this anonymous delegate.
Without this sort of technique, you would have to create a new class for every action you want to perform. And that's essentially what the command pattern is. However, the command pattern should be used really for command scenarios. It's hard to explain it actually, but it's not really appropriate to use to create a class for every action in your system, mm-hmm. for every architecture at least. Some types of UI architectures, it makes sense to have every action as a command. A lot, it doesn't. And so this is sort of our way of bridging between those scenarios where we can kind of create, we don't want to do all the work of creating a command for every action, especially when that action is really tied to the model specifically. So we create this delegating command that sort of bridges between those two allows us to continue using data binding.
And just to explain what this is actually doing, because I imagine this might be confusing to people, execute is a static class we have that exposes this Fluent APIs that we can describe what we want the command to do. So we say execute.asCommand, we pass in what the logic of the command will be. If it actually provides a condition that it translates to the command can execute. Mm. So every command has a can execute. That's part of WPF's framework. So that if actually translates to the actual delegate here. Now, and again, if you look at the XAML for this, it's really clean. And it's all bindings. There's no event handlers.
So the code behind on that.
The code behind is just setting the data context. That's all there is to it.
Wow.
And actually, in a lot of cases, in the way we build apps, we don't even have this because we only have this at the very top level, at the very root of the application, because we're basically binding to one big object graph that represents the entire application. Now something else. Actually, stop me if there's a question here too.
Well, actually, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up.
All right.
But this solution, project is out on CodePlex, right? So folks can experience the evolution of going from the anti-pattern all the way through some real sophisticated stuff there.
Yep, it's WPF patterns on CodePlex.
And we will be putting links to all the material that was discussed today on our GeekSpeak blog in a follow-up post. But just to return us back to slide decks, everybody's got the resources that people need. You can see upcoming GeekSpeak webcasts at microsoft.com/event/series/geekspeak.aspx. GeekSpeak is also being posted to Channel 9. It's a couple of weeks behind, but we're trying to get our episodes up there. We've got your guys' blogs listed here as well as ours. On the page that you're seeing, folks, there's an underscore, so it's Christopher_Banaj and Rob_Eisenberg in their blogs. Both on Devlicious, right?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. And so any last follow-ups that you would maybe give folks, any advice that they should consider as they're undertaking?
Can I throw in before, can I throw in quick?
Oh, yeah, Brian, I forgot about
I
that
I just
one.
Wanted to mention, these guys have a book, and I wanted to plug their book because it's really good. It's Sans Teach Yourself WPF in 24 Hours. And if you haven't picked this book up, it's really substantial. I know a lot of people pick up 24-hour books because they're thin and quick to go through, but this is really a book, and we've talked about this before. When we say 24 hours, it doesn't mean you'll know the whole topic the next day. It means you're going to go through 24 one-hour sessions to learn WPF. So I just wanted to plug it because it's really good. I have it open on Safari all the time, and so I just wanted to mention it.
Excellent. So any last-minute advice for our listeners, guys?
No, just that we recommend, reading blogs and reading books and looking for code examples. And really, the more time you can spend with other developers discussing these ideas, the better, because that's really where we found the fruit to be, is, talking these things through and trying to find common meaning and ways to apply them that decreases the pain of development.
Right, and we're both going to be blogging about this, so definitely check our blogs out. I've got a series of posts I'm about to start digging into different implementations of view models and how a lot of different patterns kind of come together in real apps, and hopefully going to show a few more of these same apps we're showing today, a couple more we didn't show, and talk about how we solved some problems with different patterns. So read that and post comments and questions to us on our blog. Check out Caliburn and post questions there. We've got a pretty good community developing around that, and stick with it and enjoy it. I mean, it's really a pleasure, I think, actually using these patterns once they click for you.
Yeah.
It changes the way you think about solving problems and building things, and actually makes the whole experience a lot more pleasant than without them.
Definitely. So thanks, guys, for coming on. And Brian, thanks for co-hosting.
Oh, thanks for having me. And, yeah, thank you guys for coming on. This was great.
All right. And thanks, everybody, for attending. And I'm going to turn it back over to our webcast producer to do some final wrap-up.
Thank you. I'd like to remind everyone that you may now print a PDF of the slides by clicking Control-P. You can either print or save the slides locally for your convenience. You should all be seeing a survey now in your slide area. If you could take a moment to fill it out before you log off, we do appreciate any feedback you leave for us. All you need to do is follow the links provided to complete the evaluation. And with that, I'd like to extend a special thanks to Glenn Gordon, Brian Johnson, Christopher Benage, and Rob Eisenberg for today's presentation. Thank you all for joining us today. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of today's conference.